Face it, shaker bottles suck. Your protein shake always comes out clumpy and you look like an idiot using the thing. That's why I decided to ditch my shaker bottle for good and get myself a BlendJet 2 portable blender. It makes perfectly blended protein shakes that come out smooth, creamy, and delicious in just 20 seconds. So go to BlendJet.com and use promo code DECASTPOD at checkout to get 12% off your order. That's promo code DECASTPOD to get 12% off your order at checkout.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to begin our next deep dive into a new case. Before we get started, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for The Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Podcast. You can find me on most social media networks under one of those monikers. If you enjoy what I do, would like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. We do have a new one this week from Apple Podcast. This was posted by BTS Platt. Great podcast. You leave no stone unturned. Great work. Well, thank you, BTS Platt. I appreciate your kind words and that you enjoy what I do. Another way you can help support what I do is to go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast. Make a one-time donation. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon, and for as little as $2 a month, you can become a Patreon member, like our two current Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. Both of you, I appreciate your support of this show greatly. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, got no cigarettes though, because I'm on the road again. Let's go into the crypt. So, we are going to start looking at what to me is one of the most fascinating cases of the 20th century, and that is the Wonderland Murders. I've thought about covering this case off and on over the years. I've always avoided it because others were jumping on it. However, everyone who is a fan of this show knows that I go quite a bit deeper than most when it comes to cases, and I have not seen any podcasts or documentaries that are, to me, as thorough as I would like them to be. So for those of you who are unaware of what the Wonderland Murders are, I'm going to give you a brief synopsis. In the early morning hours of July 1st, 1981, an individual or a group entered the domicile at 8763 Wonderland Avenue in the Laurel Canyon section of Los Angeles and proceeded to enact what has been described as one of the most violent and brutal murders in the history of that city. Five individuals, Barbara Richardson, Ron Launius, Joy Miller, Billy Deverell, and Susan Launius, Ron's wife, were assaulted as they slept either in beds or on the couch on the first floor in an extreme act of overkill. Now, four of these individuals ended up dying, while the fifth, Susan Launius, did survive, although she had extensive damage to her skull. And it didn't take police very long to zero in on individuals that they believed to have perpetrated this particularly heinous crime. However, unfortunately, it would be a number of years before anyone would have anything like a conviction attached to their name due to these crimes. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. I'm going to dive into the house on Wonderland Avenue. It was a fairly notorious place in the late 1970s, early 1980s. It was known as a place where you could score drugs, but you could also fence stolen property. They were also known to commit burglaries, and this gang was headed by the aforementioned Ron Lonius, who himself is a fairly interesting character, and I don't mean that in a good way. Ronald Lee Lonius was born May 18th, 1944. In Sacramento, California, he was a Vietnam vet who served in the United States Air Force, and numerous sources state that he became involved with heroin trafficking while he was stationed in Vietnam. Some places that you'll look state that Ron was one of many individuals who was responsible for the smuggling of heroin into the United States using the coffin of deceased U.S. service members. However, I could find no sources that actually provided verifiable proof that he was one of those individuals who was doing this. But it should be noted, he was dishonorably discharged after being caught and then court-martialed for the smuggling of heroin into the U.S. out of Vietnam. Returning to California, he fairly quickly got himself involved with the drug trade there. Many individuals have stated that Lonius was not much more than a burglar and a drug dealer. Many have stated that he was, in fact, a hitman for hire. The difficulty with this particular aspect of Lonius is the fact that he was never convicted of any murders, and other than hearsay and a couple of court appearances on suspicion of murder, there is nothing to verify this. I mean, he was a bad individual, this much we know. Many who knew him or knew of him believed that he was a killer for hire and had been involved in numerous killings. But as you're going to see while we go along and dissect this case, other than one or two that have tentatively been pinned to his name by law enforcement, there's really no concrete evidence to support this assertion. In addition to all of this, though, Ron was also a known drug addict, particularly of cocaine, but he was one of those who partook of anything that he could get his hands on, much as the rest of the what became known as the Wonderland Gang was. At some point, Ron married Susan in the early to mid-1970s, and it's said that their relationship was fairly troubled as Ron had an exceedingly violent temper, and she was known to have left him on various occasions because of this. Now, at the time of the murders, Susan, who was a native of Sacramento, had actually decided to try and mend fences with Ron and moved out to the Laurel Canyon area of Hollywood to be with him. Ron had a fairly extensive criminal record, as did the other members of the Wonderland Gang. Everything from possession to burglary to distribution to assault with deadly weapons. He was an all-around miserable human being. In fact, some sources state that the other members of the gang stayed with him simply because they feared the retribution that may occur should they decide to cut their ties with Alonius. However, as with other aspects of this case, that can be neither be confirmed nor denied. It's just something that I believe is important to this case to give you kind of an idea of the type of individual that Ron was. After the murders, the police really, among themselves, put it best that he, you know, his death was no great loss. That's not to say that the police or myself are advocating for the murders of these types of individuals. Rather, it shows you how lowly the police viewed him. It wasn't just the police that viewed Ron in this fashion. Most of those in the underworld in which he ran viewed Ron as somebody who you did not want to cross or have dealings with if you could avoid it, but also someone whose death kind of allowed them to breathe a collective sigh of relief. There were others within the Wonderland gang who were viewed in a similar fashion, such as David Lind, who was a supposed former Hell's Angel. And I say that because Hell's Angels have never claimed him as having been one of their own. And to be honest, he bore none of the telltale signs of having been a former member of the club. And by that I mean, generally speaking, individuals who were full-in patched members of an outlaw biker gang tend to have tattoos on their persons of the club, and when they leave, those tattoos are either tattooed over or, unfortunately, they are forcibly removed. Now, anybody who has ever seen the television show Sons of Anarchy will recall a scene where a back tattoo is forcibly removed from an ex-member. While a lot of that show was over-the-top dramatizations, that type of thing is fairly common when an individual is held in such low esteem by the club and refuses to follow their orders, i.e. in this case, removing what is considered to be club property from their person. Tattoos of the clubs are considered to be club property, and they will remove the tattoos for you, and it's not like going in and having it removed with a laser. Rather, it is a fairly horrific and brutal operation wherein they use whatever they have at hand to ensure that the individual no longer has it, but also that they also remember that they have crossed this club, and this is a punishment for having done that. So David claimed to have been a former HA. It is known that he did run with some outlaw biker types, but again, it can't be proven as to whether or not he was actually a member of that particular club. Much as the case with Ron, David had a fairly extensive criminal background, including assault, burglary, distribution, and possession of narcotics. There's a big difference, though, between David Lind and Ron, as you're going to see the further we get into looking at this case. Because whereas Ron really had no morals, and in internal memos and documentation, Ron Lornus was listed as being a psychopath, David Lynn had a moral compass, human feelings towards others. Now, in addition to Ron and David, there was also William Raymond Deverell, who was born on February 14th, 1937. It's been said that Bill was Ron's right-hand man. He was a known heroin addict, drug dealer, as well as a heavy equipment operator. The people who knew Bill said that he experienced periods of self-loathing over his actions and oftentimes would consider quitting the drug dealing and robbery game. However, the allure of easy money and getting his fix from drugs pulled him back. Barbara Lee Easton Richardson was born on October 17, 1958. She was a known drug addict as well as the current girlfriend of David Lind. You're going to see some things online stating that Lind and Richardson were both police informants. This is a Hollywood fabrication from the movie Wonderland. There is no documented evidence to state that either Lind or Richardson were police informants. In fact, all indications point to the exact opposite. Both of them were heavily involved in drug dealing, trafficking in stolen merchandise, as well as robberies. Also had Joy Miller, who was the girlfriend of Billy Devereaux, and she, as with the rest of the gang, was a known drug user. And I'm pointing this out, the fact that all of them were addicted to drugs, not as an excuse as to, they should have been removed, but rather to try and paint an image for you of the type of people that they were. If you've never had dealings with somebody who is active in addiction, there's an old statement, how do you know when a drug addict's lying? Their lips are moving. That is the type of people these individuals were. They may have had a softer side to them where they'd give you the shirt off their back, but the reality is that they were out to ensure that they could get their next fix, and they would do that by any means necessary, including robbing other drug dealers, stealing from people's homes, and obviously selling narcotics. Now, at the time of the murders, which we're going to be talking about shortly, the Wonderland Gang had become known throughout the greater Los Angeles as the most vicious and violent of all of the drug dealing organizations. This despite the fact that in reality they were not that big. What led to this reputation was Ron Launius's actions, both prior to forming the gang as well as after the fact. He was really a vicious, cunning thug. Now, I have read some articles and police records that state that the Wonderland Gang was the most feared and influential gang of its era. I haven't seen anything that points in that direction. And the reason I say that is there were much larger drug distribution networks in Los Angeles who were 100 times more feared and massively more influential. And one of those drug syndicates is going to become the focus of what eventually was dubbed the Four on the Floor murders, and that was the empire of entrepreneur Eddie Nash. People will argue that the Wonderland Gang was, feared and that nobody did business in Los Angeles without their knowledge, but the reality of the fact is they were small potatoes compared to Eddie Nash. And that's not speculation, that's verifiable. And you're going to see that as we go through the investigation of these murders, just how influential Nash was, and just how powerful he was and ruthless. See, we have the main core of the gang, In addition to that, there were various other hanger-ons and associates, one of whom was an individual by the name of Tracy McCourt, who, as with most of the other male members of the gang, had a lengthy prison record. Now, how did the Wonderland Gang operate? As I said, they were mostly known to rob other drug dealers, not only for their own fixes, but to turn around and then sell those narcotics. In fact, it seems that that was the main source of the narcotics, in this case, cocaine, that the group sold. They were known to sell other heavy drugs, such as heroin, and I've read a few accounts stating they may have been involved in the Burgoyne crystal meth distribution, but those are scattered here and there. It seems that the main source of their income was heroin and cocaine, with the emphasis being on the cocaine, as at this point in California, cocaine was the drug of choice for the wealthy and the elite, as well as your average everyday citizen. Now, the police do know that numerous celebrities visited the Wonderland House over the period of time that it was active in order to purchase cocaine from them. In order to get into this house, you had to walk down the driveway on Wonderland Avenue and kind of go around a concrete wall where there was a electronic door that was locked, and you had to be buzzed into it. And after shutting the door behind you, being confronted with their pit bull, you ascended a flight of steps and went into the house proper. The house was a split-level deal, at which point you could do your business with them, and some chose to stay at the house while others left and did their drugs elsewhere. Some reports have it that the house was notorious because of the manner of business that was done out of it, with numerous residents stating that they complained time and again to the police over the fact that individuals were coming at all hours of day or night. Many of them seemed suspicious, and there was just an overall sense of ill will towards the house on Wonderland Avenue and its occupants. Now, one of the individuals who came to frequent the Wonderland House was pornographic actor John C. Holmes. If you don't know who John Holmes is, he was the inspiration for the movie Boogie Nights. He was really the focal point of the film Wonderland, which, while dismissed by the investigators of this case, I personally enjoyed. I thought it was a fascinating look at this crime, despite the fact that there was a lot of liberties taken with the story. We're going to look at John Holmes briefly. John Curtis Estes was born August 8th, 1944 in Asheville, Ohio, which is roughly 11 or so miles south of Columbus. And John was the youngest of four children born to Mary and Carl Estes. Now, Carl worked as a railroad worker, and it seems as though Holmes had a fairly troubled upbringing, as his mother was not married to Carl Estes, and in fact, the father of her other three children was an individual by the name of Edgar Harvey Holmes, who Mary married at least three times between 1936 and 1947. Now, Edgar was quite a bit older than Mary at the time of their first marriage, where he was 35, Mary was only 17 years old. At some point during his childhood, Mary Holmes changed her son's surname from Estes to Holmes. And at least according to some sources, Holmes didn't even know that Edgar Holmes was his biological father until very close to the end of his life in the mid to late 1980s when he went to get a passport. Some sources state that Mary Holmes was a devout Southern Baptist and her children were required to attend church with her on a regular basis. Again, Holmes had a troubled upbringing. It's said that his father, Edgar, was a horrific alcoholic who would beat the children as well as vomit on them, although I can't verify this particular piece of information. It is known that when Mary left Edgar Holmes for the last time, she moved to Columbus into a housing project where she moved in with a friend who also had two children, and that the two women worked multiple jobs in order to provide for all five of the children. In December of 1951, Holmes' mother married for a fourth time, this time to a man by the name of Harold Bowman, at which point the family moved to the town of Pataskala, Ohio. Now, according to Holmes, his stepfather, Harold, was a decent individual and a good father until Holmes' youngest brother, David, was born, at which point, again, this is according to Holmes, his stepfather lost all interest in the other children and began neglecting them, instead lavishing his attention on David. This is one of those things that we have to take with a grain of salt because Holmes was a notorious liar and was not known to tell the same story twice, nor was he known to tell a story that would not serve his own agenda in some way. At the age of 15, John Holmes dropped out of high school, and with his mother's written permission, he ends up joining the United States Army, spending most of the next 3 years in West Germany working for the Signal Corps. He ends up being honorably discharged in 1963, and instead of going home to Ohio, Holmes moves to California, where he begins taking on a series of menial jobs, such as busboy, door-to-door salesman, and factory worker in order to support himself. In 1964, Holmes was working a job as an ambulance driver when he met a woman by the name of Sharon Gebenini, who was studying to become a nurse. Holmes ends up getting a job as a forklift driver in 1965. This was in April. And that August, he and Sharon ended up getting married at Fort Ord, which is a military base in the Monterey Bay area. All accounts, Holmes ended up coming down with some pretty serious medical conditions as a result of working at this meatpacking plant, leading to him leaving the job after it began affecting his lungs. According to Sharon, during this period of time in their marriage, she and Holmes attempted to conceive a child. However, they were unable to do this, and she ended up miscarrying at least three times. Now, the story of how John Holmes ended up coming into the pornographic film industry is disputed. Holmes stated that he was at a men's card game and using a urinal when the man next to him noticed his unusually large penis and handed Holmes a business card. Whether this is true or not is up for debate, but what is known is that Holmes was unusually well endowed. Remember, he was a very tall, lanky individual, and he was packing some heat down there. So Holmes ends up being lured into the life of a pornographic actor. You do have to remember that during this period of time, pornography was illegal in the United States, particularly films. So Holmes is already, from the get-go, in the bed with some very seedy underworld characters. Holmes ends up doing some nude male modeling as well as participating in stag reels or loops, which if you're not familiar with that, what that is, stag reels and loops were very short pieces of film. Oftentimes they would be inside of a machine where the viewer would drop money into it and would get to see, let's just say hypothetically, 30 seconds of the film, and if they wanted to see more, they had to drop more of it money into these machines. If you want to get a better understanding about how these machines worked, who operated them, there was a man by the name of Mike Thevis, who operated out of Atlanta. He was known as the King of Porn. And a number of years ago, there was a very good podcast done on him, his rise as well as his fall, eventual conviction to prison. Well, Thevis really cornered the market on these types of machines with the help of the five families out of New York. The mafia was and continues to be heavily involved in the adult film industry, which at this point in time was still in its infancy when Holmes comes into it. He starts starring in these reels. It wasn't the type of thing that you envision when you think of pornography. It was, like I said, there were short clips. Stag films, you know, were just be a very quick sex scene, and that was it. Now, it is known that Holmes was a fairly shy individual and had difficulty doing these types of things. However, we're talking about the porno business, and then, as is now, a lot of drugs were around during this period of time. I don't know if it was necessarily cocaine that was in the picture. Remember, we're talking about the late 1960s, early 1970s, but there were certainly some form of narcotics around in which to kind of ease the performers into doing the things that were needed to be done on film. Most of these productions were kind of done in a fly-by-night operation where the production team as well as the performers would show up, be it at a hotel room or a warehouse that they did for the day. They'd film the scenes and then get out of there as fast as possible, lest the vice squad show up and arrest everybody involved. Sharon is known to have been absolutely disgusted with Holmes' choice of a career, although Holmes was very good at cajoling her into getting Sharon to see his point of view and into getting her to go along with the things he wanted. However, I am going to point out Sharon Holmes was a very strong individual, and you're going to see eventually she just has enough of John Holmes' shit and says, I'm not dealing with it. But it was a long struggle for her to get to that point, and I have to honestly believe that a good portion of that struggle came from the fact that John Holmes was her first love. Now, in the early 1970s, 1970, 1971, Holmes ends up coming into contact with an individual by the name of Robert Chin. Chin was a graduate of the UCLA Film School. And eventually, he got into the porno business, probably because he realized he wasn't going to be able to make it as a mainstream film director. So the two of them meet somewhere around 1970, 1971, and Chin begins to craft a porno character for John Holmes. Specifically, he created this character with Holmes in mind. This character's name was Johnny Wadd, who was a private investigator. For younger listeners out there who are unaware, up until the mid to late 1990s, porn films actually had a plot. They were absolutely implausible, but they at least attempted to have some semblance of a plot. And one of the reasons for this was they were trying to avoid violating obscenity laws. They could skirt around these by saying that the sex acts that were performed on camera were simply an expression of the artistic direction of the film and the actors, as opposed to being just outright sex scenes, which is why you had films such as this and much later on Deep Throat and Behind the Green Door, Caligula by Bob Guccione of Penthouse fame. They had to have some reason if they were brought to court in order to say that, you know, hey, we're not just making smut look, there's artistry involved in this. So this Bob Chin ends up creating this character, Johnny Wad, and casting Holmes in it. And Holmes ends up becoming somewhat famous for this role. Do not believe movies like Boogie Nights and documentaries that you see where they act as though John Holmes was a breakout, internationally known porno star. That wasn't the case. He was well known by those who viewed pornographic films during this period of time, but outside of that, nobody knew who he was. Because unlike today, pornography was extremely taboo, and people didn't let others know that they watched it or that they went to theaters to see it. It was akin to telling people that you like watching, you know, sheep fuck. I'm not sugarcoating it. I mean, that's really how it was viewed within America. It was very taboo, so in addition to having these fly-by-night operations, they would screen the films, you know, for short periods of time at film festivals and, you know, maybe a night or two at an actual movie theater before sending the film somewhere else in an attempt to stay one step ahead of the law. Again, because if they did not do this, there was a very good chance that the police were going to get involved and everyone who had participated in the creation of this film was going to have obscenity charges pressed against them, even in California of the late 60s or early 1970s. After the release of the first Johnny Wad film, people start to take notice. Chun and Holmes start making more films in the Johnny Wad series as they were becoming popular. Holmes' career was helped greatly by the fact that the movie Deep Throat was released in 1972, and it was the first, and let's be honest about this, the only adult film that had mainstream success because of the fact that it was such a departure and that the producers of the film took such a risque stance in pandering it to the public at large as opposed to sending it to the porno houses and the loop reel factories to get it distributed. So now Holmes is starting to become known within a wider array of American society, but even still, he wasn't somebody that would be instantly recognizable on the street, such as, you know, a Ron Jeremy, or, you know, going to contemporary actors of that time, someone like, you know, Robert De Niro. It was still a very niche audience. According to police records, Holmes was arrested a number of times. During this period, Holmes was arrested on a number of occasions for pimping. Some accounts I have read state that Holmes was in fact pimping his wife out, although I highly doubt this. Sharon was much too stand up of an individual to have allowed herself to be pressured into that kind of lifestyle. All of this is going on. Sharon's working as a nurse, Holmes is working in the adult film industry, as well as working various odd jobs. In concurrence with all of this, Holmes picks up a cocaine habit, which is going to end up controlling his entire life until the day he dies. One of the odd jobs that Holmes picks up during this period of time, the mid-1960s, is as the live-in maintenance manager of an apartment complex, where he comes into contact with a 15-year-old by the name of Dawn Schiller. Now, you've heard me mention my friend Ed Opperman, who's a private investigator. He has his own podcast, radio show known as The Opperman Report. And a few years ago, he did an absolutely fascinating and mind-blowing interview with Miss Schiller, where she discussed first meeting John Holmes as well as the life that they had together. I'm not going to get into all the particulars of Dawn Schiller's life. From her own accounts, she had a fairly turbulent upbringing, and she ends up moving out to the West Coast from Florida with her father, and I believe it was her sister, although I may be mistaken on that particular aspect of her life. Her father introduced her to marijuana, and it was on moving into this apartment complex with her father, who I believe was a veteran on disability, that she first encountered John Holmes. And not knowing anything, Schiller didn't realize that Holmes began to groom her from the very beginning of that relationship. He saw that it was these girls are impoverished with the father being on disability, etc., etc. So he starts buying them things like food, which they didn't have, and taking them out for ice cream, that type of thing. All the while, Holmes is weaseling his way in and getting closer and closer to Dawn. There are some within the adult film industry who have attempted to refute this portrayal of John Holmes. I find her story highly believable, especially given all of the information we have concerning John Curtis Holmes since his death, and what a truly despicable human being he was deep down to the core of himself. What Dawn and Sharon ended up becoming friends, and it's highly likely that Sharon realized her husband was having an extramarital affair. There was little that she could do about it, however, as her husband's also involved in the porn industry and sleeping with untold amount of women for a paycheck. During this period of time, it's estimated Holmes was earning about $3,000 a day for a single shoot, which in turn would go right back up his nose. I'm not going to sugarcoat things when it comes to John Holmes. I know the media has continuously tried to portray him in a more favorable light than he deserves. John Holmes was an empty-headed, conniving, cokehead son of a bitch who saw a very young girl in a very bad situation and decided to exploit that situation for his own means. In very short order, he introduces Dawn to cocaine, and they begin a sexual relationship, which is going to end up becoming a very manipulative and abusive relationship, with Holmes forcing Dawn on numerous occasions to sell her body in order that they can survive. And one of the individuals that Dawn is going to be forced to sell her body to is a man by the name of Eddie Nash. Now, if John Holmes is the linchpin upon which everything else is hung, then Eddie Nash is the force which causes all parts to move. Eddie Nash was born Adele Gharibi Nasrallah on April 3rd, 1929 in Ramallah, British Palestine. He was the son of an Orthodox Christian family, and according to a Rolling Stones article, his family was fairly wealthy. Prior to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, the family is estimated to have owned at least 48 hotels. At some point at the beginning of the 1950s, Nash immigrates to the United States. Again, this is according to a Rolling Stones article, with only $7 in his pocket. Nash begins picking up work as a bit part player in various television shows and movies, more often than not as a stuntman. It was said of Nash that he was an expert horseman. By the 1960s, Nash had moved away from being involved with the entertainment industry and purchased himself a hot dog stand called Beef Chucks, which was on North Hollywood Boulevard. Nash was in turn able to turn around and build an empire from this hot dog stand as he began purchasing and operating various nightclubs throughout Hollywood. Some of these you may be familiar with, such as the Starwood, Sold Out, the Odyssey Disco, the Paradise Ballroom, the Seven Seas, Alibaba's, and the Kit Kat Strip Club. Now, each one of these clubs that Nash was operating was targeted at a specific set of clientele, be they the Hollywood types, or, you know, gay males, or bisexuals. He really targeted each club to serve that specific clientele, and he very quickly amassed a fairly substantial amount of money. However, what is not known is how Nash was able to go from an immigrant with $7 in his pocket to a multimillionaire, which by the beginning of the 1970s, he most certainly was. What we do know of Nash is that he was very good at forming alliances with individuals who were in power and solidifying those alliances. I'm not talking people within Hollywood, although I'm sure there were many of those. I'm talking people within the political spectrum who, once they were in Nash's good graces, very rarely, if ever, left his orbit. And Nash, as you're going to see in the next episode when we get into the actual murders, was able to use these alliances and these friendships to repeatedly keep himself out of trouble. It's known that by the 70s, Nash was heavily involved in the drug trade, despite his protestations for decades that he was a simple businessman. Court records and convictions don't lie, especially when you're dealing with an individual such as Eddie Nash. Much as John Holmes was a despicable human being, Eddie Nash was an awful, disgusting individual who was known to do such things as leave the bathrooms in his home without toilet paper and then coerce the young women who were brought into his lair into licking him clean in order to get a bump of cocaine. That is exactly the kind of thing Eddie Nash did, especially once he got power. He was not an attractive or pleasant man to be around, and he would have individuals within his sphere of influence trick young women to come up to Nash's home, at which point they would be exploited by Nash for his own ends. Dawn Schiller was one of, God alone knows how many, young women who fell victim to this absolute garbage human being, and those within his inner circle. So now you have a general idea of all of the players within the actual crime itself. We're going to move on to
what precipitated the crime, which at the time that the murders were committed, the police had no idea about. Alright, so we discussed the Wonderland Gang and the fact that John Holmes had a fairly heavy cocaine addiction. All this included powder cocaine as well as freebasing. By 1980-1981, John Holmes was a frequent visitor to the Wonderland House. But in addition to that, Holmes was also a patron of Eddie Nash's home. Nash saw him as something of a mascot and would frequently allow Holmes to come up there and do drugs with them so that he could show John Holmes off to all of the people coming by the house. Because of his extreme addiction to cocaine, obviously John Holmes starts doing things that a sane, rational human being would not do. Namely, Holmes becomes your atypical junkie who is going to steal everything that is not nailed down so that he can sell it in order to further his addiction. By this point, John Holmes and his wife Sharon had separated, with Sharon moving to a different town in order to get away from John Holmes. So now it's John Holmes and his erstwhile girlfriend, Dawn. And Holmes is fluttering from flophouse to flophouse. This is basically, you know, the by the hour or, you know, really seedy motels. He's working sporadically because his dependency on cocaine has severely begun to affect his ability to perform in front of cameras. So because of all of this, Holmes' life is just an absolute shambles. And pretty much everyone who knows him understands that John Holmes is not somebody that you can trust. The only person that doesn't seem to grasp that at this point, at least not fully, is Dawn. Their relationship has grown to such that she is really locked to John Holmes. There are accounts from Dawn of violence on Holmes' part, after which he is beyond remorseful, bawling his eyes out, that type of thing. Meanwhile, he's, you know, doing that and then demanding that she go out and prostitute herself in order to get them money or in order to pay off drug debts. They are living life on the edge of a lightning bolt, to coin a phrase from Dusty Rhodes, and it's quickly spiraling out of control. Not to say that it wasn't out of control prior to this. Now, as I stated, John Holmes was a patron of both Eddie Nash as well as the Wonderland Gang. And it's been stated that John Holmes lived in constant fear of Ron Laurinaitis because Ron habitually went out of his way to embarrass and belittle Holmes, whom Ron saw as nothing more than your everyday junkie. Now, if you've seen the film Wonderland, I know they try and portray the Wonderland Gang as something like a family. They were not. They were a group of junkies who were living life off of the backs of other junkies. They had a very widespread network of individuals whom they did business with, many of whom you're going to meet in the coming episodes. These individuals either sold drugs for them or fenced hot items for them in order to continue perpetuating the drug empire that they were running. By the timeline that we're at now, it is June 28th, June 29th, 1981. Everyone in the Wonderland Gang is strung out. Most, if not all, of their associates are strung out. And Eddie Nash is strung out. He has become one of those drug dealers who breaks the cardinal rule and starts getting high on his own supply. And it's because of this that Nash's
otherwise keen sense of self-preservation is at an all-time low, which is probably why he allowed an individual such as John Holmes over into his house and into his life. Nash believed himself to be an untouchable drug kingpin, which is understandable. He had a reputation for ruthlessness that, while not known to the general public or to the police, was at least understood by those who operated in the criminal underbelly of Los Angeles. You don't cross Eddie Nash if you want to walk away from it. This is where John Holmes and the Wonderland Gang come in. Whether it was because John Holmes and the rest of the Wonderland Gang were so strung out, or they just believed that Nash would not be able to trace any of this back to them, on the 28th, 29th, Holmes is over at the Wonderland House, and Ron and company are trying to figure out another big score. Now, they were at least aware of Nash in some regards, as Holmes had been able to sell a set of antique rifles to Eddie Nash, which we're going to talk about more in a future episode. These rifles were believed to have been stolen from an individual that the Wonderland Gang robbed. When trying to come up with a score, John Holmes brings up Eddie Nash and lets them know that, hey, you know, the guy's like my best friend. He trusts me implicitly. Plus, he's got a safe in his house that's filled with gold, cash, and a lot of drugs. I could go up in there and I can leave the house unlocked and you guys can head back in there and you can rob him. Just make sure he doesn't know that I set this up and that I get a cut of this thing. They agree to it. Now, there's some stories out there that say that John Holmes had to be bullied into setting up this robbery for Lonius and the other individuals in the Wonderland Gang, while other stories have it that Holmes readily offered this information to them as he saw it as an opportunity to, you know, score big in terms of drugs and cash. I tend to believe that John Holmes was more likely than not so far gone at this point that had he known, you know, the boss of one of the five families, he would have suggested that they rob him so that he could get a slice of that particular pie. So on the 28th, John Holmes is known to have gone over to Eddie Nash's house on at least three separate occasions. Apparently, the first time he went there, he did not go through with the plan, so he returned a subsequent time and left the sliding glass door unlocked before returning later on that day and making certain that it was unlocked. So the following day, on June 29th, 1981, a 1975 Ford Granada pulled up outside of Nash's home on Dona Lola Place, which is in the Studio City section of Los Angeles's San Fernando Valley. Some sources state that everyone in the Wonderland Gang was in on this robbery on the morning of the 29th. I tend to believe David Lynn's testimony as to what occurred. According to him, present in the car were Ron Lonius, Billy Deverill, himself, and Tracy McCourt, who was acting as the getaway driver. So they get to the house, and the three men, Ron, Billy, and David, they go into the house armed to the teeth, and they take Nash and his bodyguard by surprise. Now, this bodyguard Gregory Dials. They ended up roughing the three of these guys up, and at least according to Lynn, Ron Launius had gone in there with plans to kill both of the men, and that it was he himself, meaning Lynn, who talked Ron out of committing this act of murder. Instead, Ron goes about humiliating the two men, making Nash get on his hands and knees and beg for his life, crying, forcing a gun into Nash's mouth, and pretty much just doing everything he can to degrade this big-time drug dealer. And at some point in all of this, Lind ends up shooting Dills, accidentally grazing his side, which causes Dills to collapse to the ground. After this, Nash is dragged to his bedroom at gunpoint, where Ron forces him to open the floor safe, which, it must be noted, very few people knew about. Inside of this safe, it's been said that there was at least $100,000 in cash and jewelry, as well as copious amounts of narcotics and one gun. So after emptying this, the assailants pull a shower curtain off and put all of their booty on it before stripping Nash and Dials of all of their valuables and grabbing anything else inside of the house that's worth grabbing. After this, they tie the two men up with tape binding their hands and feet, at which point the trio continued abusing Nash and Dials, humiliating them as best they possibly could. While this is going on, they continued to ransack the house, getting their hands on two antique rifles, which I'd already mentioned had been sold to Nash. At this point, Billy Devereaux ends up going around and cutting all of the telephone lines in the house, and informed their two captives that it would be in everyone's best interest that Nash and Dials not attempt to undo their bindings until long after the trio has left, unless, of course, that is that Nash and Dials wants to die. Now, in subsequent investigations, it was learned that a third individual was present in the house at this time by the name of Jamie McQuan. Now, Jamie is said to have either been Nash's girlfriend or a sex slave, although by most accounts, she falls more into the girlfriend category than she does sex slave. Any event, she was in the house as well, but she was so fucked up from drugs that she was unconscious for most of this. After gathering together all of their booty, the three members of the Wonderland Gang make their way back outside to the Ford Granada, where Tracy McCourt is waiting. They throw the loot inside, ignoring the small baubles that had fallen out of the shower curtain along the way, and ordered Tracy to start driving. However, there's a problem. They're so fucked up that nobody realized that the car was driving around on empty, and in fact, they basically coasted down the hill and back to the Wonderland house, with David Lind later stating that had a police officer decided to pull the four of them over on that night, none of the subsequent murders would likely have taken place, as they all would have been in prison for having stolen property, large amounts of narcotics, as well as an untraceable amount of cash on them. As it was, the trio ends up getting back to Wonderland on fumes, and they find the rest of the gang along with John Holmes waiting for them. Now, what happens next has been described as a sense of excitement and revelry as they go inside the house and show off their ill-gotten gains. I want to point out, just for the sake of completeness, that none of the actual members of the Wonderland Gang's names were on the lease of this house. It was actually Joy Miller, Billy Devereaux's girlfriend, whose name was on the lease, thus keeping the other occupants off of anybody's radar. Now, supposedly, Tracy McCourt and John Holmes ended up being given what amounted to less than half a share of what was taken from Nash's home. And apparently John Holmes had some serious resentment over this, as he had been looking forward to a much bigger piece of the action, given the fact that he had just betrayed his benefactor in order to facilitate his drug dealers in getting this major score. Also, according to Lind, Holmes attempted to press this issue with Ron and was very quickly rebuffed, and Holmes decided not to press this issue any further. Again, according to Lind and others who were there who survived, after the divvying up of the loot, a party broke out at the Wonderland house, although Holmes ended up leaving early, obviously upset over the fact that he felt he deserved a much larger share than he had gotten. We're going to discuss what happens in the days, weeks, and months following this robbery in the next episode. I'm going to cut it off at this point as we have gone over the 1 hour mark, but I at least wanted to get to the catalyst to the crime that is going to occur in this episode. Again, I hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Deathcast. Please leave a 5-star review wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Follow me on social media. Consider making a donation at buymeacoffee.com. And if you really like what I do, please consider going to tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon and becoming a Patreon member. Until next time, the Deathcast is a co-production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid.